You're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums Is Here Before You Die. This episode we'll be talking about Sonic Youth, Goo. In the room I have Rob.
It's still a me.
And John.
Hello.
And on the line we have Ben.
Hey-o.
Goo is the sixth full-length studio album by American alternative rock band Sonic Youth, released on June 26th, 1990 on DGC Records. The producer was Nick Sanson and Ron St. Germain. And Sonic Youth and the genre is alternative rock and hard rock. I'm going to read from the book, Rod Stanley. A year after Goo's release, filmmaker Dave Marquis traveled to Europe with Sonic Youth. The resulting documentary, 1991, The Year That Punk Broke, is a fascinating, chaotic document of a time when Dinosaur Jr. and the nascent Nirvana found themselves poised on the brink of massive international success. Although Goo was their first album on a major label, it was no sellout, boasting backing tracks and vocals from Dinosaur Jr.'s Jay Maskus, and ahead of the time crossover with Public Enemy's Chuck D on Cool Thing. Goo was accessible in terms of song and structure, yet still experimental in tone and texture. Lyrics about Karen Carpenter's death from anorexia on Tunic and the one-minute freakout such as Scooter and Jinx pointed to continued creative control, while ultra-cool artists Raymond Pettibon's nihilistic comic chic sleeve paraded their continued hipness. While many tip the critical nod to Daydream Nation, Goo remains a masterclass in how an underground rock band can make the jump to a major label and not only survive with its soul and balls intact, but flourish and reach a wider appreciative audience. Can hardly read it because I'm so excited. All right, what do we think of Sonic Youth, Goo?
It's all right.
I'm going to agree with Rob.
It's fine.
What do you think, Bert?
Oh, my God. So good. Love it so much.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
No, I'm serious. I don't get it. Like, oh. I get good parts of it. I get lots of chunks of it. But then there are parts where I'm just like, other than to show that you have creative control, I'm not getting it. And maybe I need to listen to it more, but there are definitely parts where, you know, like Mildred Pierce, and I guess you're, you know, putting out your punk ethos and just still laying it down. Mm-hmm. But it's like, if you're going to make the jump to Geffen, you're on a major label. Mm-hmm. I think they're still getting released on like, not on Geffen's named label, but on like their minor.
No, DGC.
Right.
Or DGC is a subsidiary.
Right. David Geffen CD.
CD?
I think it's the David Geffen Company.
Ah, yeah. There you go. Makes sense. But not on Geffen.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, like, they are trying to be a bit more commercial. They are, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's some things in here that are much more palatable than their prior stuff for the general populace, but it's not, and I guess maybe that's part of it is like saying, no, we're still us, you know, mm-hmm. but yeah, it doesn't seem, I don't know. For me, some of these things just don't hit, you know, other parts of them are just amazing. You know, Dirty Boots, Tunic, you know, basically the front half of the album hits really hard. But then I didn't like My Friend Goo, and I don't know. It just didn't grab me completely.
Aww. Yeah.
I know. Something's wrong with me. I need help.
No. I'm hearing this. I'm here for this for sure. Cool. Okay. So Dirty Boots, Tunic, even like Mary Christ,
love
which
it.
Is okay.
Yeah.
Cause that one's very similar to, My Friend Goo or even Sonic Cool Thing. It's got a dirty sort of production.
Yeah. No, I'm into that, but
huh.
It, I don't know. It for some reason my friend Goo fell off for me. It just I don't know. It just there's a sentiment to the work, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a difference between when, you know, Kim is singing or when Thurston's singing and, you know, how they're bringing forward the sound, you know, is it that guitar driven or is it something trying to lay down a bit more of a artistic, you know, almost spoken word at times.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just didn't speak to me.
Cool. Love hearing that. Did it come back around though? Did you feel,
I listened to it.
Titanium Exposé.
Yeah. Titanium Exposé. I liked it other than, and it's done, you know, we've had album after album where this happens, where a band that likes to say, you know, I've got, you know, all this sound equipment prepared, I'm going to lay out a cacophonous, you know, destructive end or a middle of a song that's mm-hmm. just a blast, you know, and you don't, and it's, you know, what am I saying with that? And for me personally, like when you just blast me out my ears for no reason, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of an album or something like that, it doesn't, I don't think that's a powerful message. I think mm-hmm. it's intended to be, but it doesn't speak to me.
Interesting.
So Titanium Exposé didn't really work for me. Scooter and Jinx was not bad because of, you know, I understood where they were going.
It's a minute.
Yeah, it's a minute. It's a, you know, a use of an exploded amp sound.
Yeah.
You know, I get it a bit, but yeah. And I like Noise, you know, I like, you know, The Locust, you know, I like Cobra Kai, but I don't know. It just has to make more sense to me for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm not a lyric boy. Yeah. I just go like, I never pay attention to lyrics. I'm a tone and feel dude. And for me, this record is all fucking like, it checks all of my boxes of things that make excite me.
This is pure Gaby for Robbie.
Yeah, kind of. This is, you could put this under like a, just like under a boulder with a stick. And yeah, I would be crushed by it. If I was like, oh.
What is it that you guys, I mean, I want to feel the way you guys feel. I want to feel good.
I like the atonal, I like the alternate tunings that give these really fucking nutso, like just discordant, like, tones. And I just think that Lee Rinaldo is the bee's knees.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Kyle couldn't join us, but he wanted to mention that Moat is his favorite Sonic Youth song. And I don't know if I can go that far, but man, Moat is one of the best Sonic Youth songs and people love it so much. And Lee is like so enamored that people are very into Moat.
Is it if I understood the process to make the music more, I would love it more?
No,
I don't think so.
I never knew how they did any of this. It was just magic.
I think for me, what it started to like seep into my brain, and this is definitely, I will say, it is a bias from getting there in high school. It's one of those things for sure. So I can't unsee that sort of music. But at this time, I was getting into Fugazi. I was getting into Sonic Youth. I had already, you know, I was in love with Dead Kennedys and all the punk stuff, you know, like that we kind of all grew up on. But there was something about it where the song would like almost in. I mean, we're listening to Tunic right now. And at that moment, what was it, about 2 minutes in, it's like the song's over and you're like, oh, the song's over. And then it comes back in, you know, it's like, in seeing them live, like really honed that feeling for me that, which they had stolen from other artists from New York, the guitar, you know, driven orchestras, Glenn Branca and all these like experimental guys, right, who were doing like 30 guitars. But then when everybody's playing the same thing and not everybody's in time, so it gets a little like off. And you almost have we're going to talk about it with some other bands that are coming up, but you almost have like a waking dream sort of state. And Sonic Youth has always been able to do that for me. They can transport me to this other space, flipping on my brain, and then all of a sudden it kicks back into like a chorus and I'm like, oh, I'm back in a song, you know. There, it's just something that they've been able to like transcend for me, that they do these like weird swirling patterns but then come always kind of like focus you back. I don't know if I explained that.
No, I think you're I think I get it. I just, maybe, you know, it's like ASMR for some people. Like, yeah. For some, it hits and it, you know, it really, you know, triggers that part of your brain. And for others, it maybe doesn't. Maybe I just got too much Neanderthal or something. No,
the Krautrockers called it phasing.
There you go.
But they didn't snap back the way that Sonic Youth does, which is pretty fucking neat. Yes, Ben.
I like the thick ass tone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like that big old thick tone.
I heard a rumor when I was in like middle school or like early high school. I don't know. I didn't have the internet then. I don't know if there's any truth for it, to it. But I heard that Sonic Youth would take on tour a guitar in a bag, and it would just be, it'd just be in a bag, loaded in, loaded out, unopened, dragged around on tour the entire tour. Then they'd get home from the tour, take the guitar out of the bag. They would all tune to that guitar, and they would write shit.
Nah, no. I love it. River, I love that.
I love it, but nah.
At this time, they were touring with Neil Young.
Fuck yes, dude. Yeah. That show, goddamn.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he, you know, he was taking the young up and comers out on tour with him, and a
so
lot
this
of
would have been his Faded Glory tour, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hell, you know, yeah.
They said, you know, not a lot of people got us. They were just like, who are these kids? They're just making a lot of racket. You know, I want Neil Young and things like that. But I guess Neil Young got so hyped and during
Grandpa Granola got hyped.
Yeah. And he started coming out of his dressing room early when they were, you know, closing out their set, and he would just sit under the stage and vibe to like the noise and like feedback that they were producing on the, like a lot of times they would end with like Expressway to Your Skull or something like extended jam. And he was just vibing to it. And I can just feel like Neil Young, and he just loved it. It's amazing. They
grumpy
eventually
old Neil
were
Young,
like,
he likes when you break the rules.
Yeah.
Musical rules were made to be broken, says grumpy old Neil Young.
known model train enthusiast Neil
Young. Unlike model trains, music rules were made to be broken. Model trains were made to be preserved and played with very carefully.
Yeah. After that, though, Moore says, one night I said to him, you know, it'd be really cool if you took all these endings that you're doing and make a record out of it. Like, because Neil Young was doing like these extended jams. And Neil Young's manager was right there and is looking at Thurston Moore, and he's like, please don't say that to him.
Hey, speaking of, Crazy Horse has a new album coming out this month, November 2022. It's Neil Young's 42nd studio album.
Fucking cool, man. So cool.
Man.
Yeah, Merry Christ fucking rules, dude. That is a...
Yeah.
Killer song.
Loved it. I should mention,
that was the
too,
first one that grabbed me off the record.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was like the like Thurston and Kim's like call and response that they do. That grabbed my ear right away.
Nice.
Yeah. Now we got Cool Thing. A track that charted.
Amazing.
Actually fucking charted.
It's their highest chart position to date. Number 96 on the Billboard 200. Although lacked significant radio airplay. Yeah, but obviously Chuck D.
Yeah. Fucking cred, dude.
Was on there. They were recording in the same studio at the same time that Public Enemy was. So they said that Flavor Flav would spill over and check him out and, you know, kind of talk shop a little bit. But Eric Vietnam Sadler was the one who was most interested in these, you know, noisy kids.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah. That these, were making
these are
all
Doctor
this
of Noise.
Yeah.
These are not kids. These are elder statesmen. Yes. Yeah,
at this point, yeah.
Album, States people. Album six.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. But yeah, Vietnam popped in, and then, you know, Chuck just rambled in. They asked him if he wanted to hear a song first for Cool Thing, and he was like, nah, it's all right. I'll just put the headphones on, just run it. And it was one take. He just listened, heard Kim's reaction in the middle, and just flowed, freestyled, and that was it.
Yeah, just do, I mean, cool, and you can hear it. It sounds like ad libs, but they're beautiful, solid ad libs. They add a lot to the track.
Yeah,
like reading between the lines of the lyrics, this is LL Cool Thing, right?
Yeah, it's that not so vague.
Yeah.
Yes, Kim actually did an interview with him.
Sitting with a kitty.
But before this, and for Spin magazine, and so it's kind of a famous, you know, back and forth with them talking about it. And she, it's an interesting read. She's kind of talking about, you know, what is
she was
mean?
Really into radio, right?
Yeah, yeah. She was. Yeah. They were very into LL Cool J. at the time too, and Public Enemy. I mean, they were super interested in, you know, what would be considered like new rap at the time, just walking around New York and hearing it just coming out from streets and cars and things. But she goes on to try to like explain. She's like, oh yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like this. Do you know about CBGBs? Do you know about like hardcore music and, you know, these bands? And he's like, no, don't really know about that. And then she would like mocks herself for being like, why would I assume like someone would like know my thing? Or so she gets like different takes, different perspectives on people who are in punk rock, people who are into rap, and what they think of the other genre, essentially.
Mm. Call up the Beastie Boys. They have lots to say.
Yeah, exactly. She did mention them. She was like, yeah, Beastie Boys used to be into hardcore before. It's amazing. All right, what do I want to talk about? What do we want to talk about?
I don't know, buddy. You got
So producer Nick Simsano recorded Daydream Nation. He started recording this, but he didn't finish it. And it sounds like he was pretty hurt when they took their project elsewhere. He didn't talk to Sonic Youth for like years. Do you know why they pulled the project from him?
Yeah, they were given more money. I mean, more money than they had ever been given to record an album. They had some time, and it became one of those things where Lee was starting to, I'll just quote him. It was a first record for a major label. We wanted it to be really good. We were getting 5 or 10 times the amount of money to record than we'd ever spent before. How good can we make a record sound compared to Aerosmith, who spends that much money on every record? We did tons and tons of overdubs. And I remember thinking at one point we just had just taken the basic tracks and did it as a group and added the vocals. And then we would have had this record and it would have been even more powerful than what we ended up with. Maybe that's a dream for someday for someone to try to remix like that. But essentially they started recording and then they just had this, they could see themselves like getting into this mindset of overthinking and being like, oh, we have all this money, we have this really nice studio. And then they were worried that he was like mixing it in a way that they were not happy with. They thought it was gearing more towards what would be like commercial or polished. And they were like, we just need to part ways because they were thinking about it wrong. And essentially they split ties with him and they thought about doing it themselves before they brought on a Ron St. Germain, but it wasn't clicking. There was sort of a way that they were recording and they just didn't want it to go down that path. But yeah, I don't know. It sounds good.
It does sound good.
I have pretty much no complaints on this.
Oh, so this album cover, really cool album cover. I saw this album cover for decades before I knew what it was actually a drawing of. I'm sure that our British listeners are more familiar with the image than I was growing up in Indiana. That image is Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, who were convicted of the Moors murders near Manchester in the early mid 1960s. That photo was them showing up to trial looking cool as fuck. bad people looking awesome.
Weren't they just witnesses though?
They were convicted of it. They may have only been testifying as witnesses at that time, but first sentence, the Moors murders were carried out by Ian Brady and Myra Hindley between July 1963 and October 1965.
Okay.
But Marlene Hindley and David Smith, who are the people who are in there, are just the key witnesses in the 1966 Moors.
Okay.
So it's not.
The image is not of the.
It's not of the murderers.
Yes. It's the witnesses.
That's not of Ian and Myra. That's. What is it? Is it Myra's? It's one of their siblings, right?
Right. Marlene.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I can see where it's confusing because they have the same last name.
Right.
Yeah, didn't like a lot of people emulate that look? Like,
it's one of the cool. most parodied covers of all time. And recently, Sonic Youth was like, "We're trying to collect every parody that we can of this cover." And he's like, "There's thousands of them, and people send them to him all the time."
Hopefully, they have the Steely Dan one.
I do have that shirt.
Yeah,
the Steely Dan one.
They love it though. They're like, every time we see it, we get excited about it. I thought that was so nice that they and also I should mention Pettibon is also a sort of a label mate from their previous record label SST, and he is brothers with
did all the Black Flag covers,
Greg Ginn.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, a lot of interconnection there.
Do we want to, since we're going from that angle a little bit, not that it's directly related to Songs About Fucking, but the original or test name for the album?
Yep.
Do you know what that is, Ben?
Oh, yeah. Blowjob?
Yeah. And, yeah, with the question mark. Yeah.
I love it.
I like the story behind it too. We're considering testing the limits of DGC. So to test the limit, well, how about blowjob?
It had a black and white drawing of Joan Crawford with her big face and these huge red lips. Said, blowjob.
But I do love that, like, shot across the bow of the right. new label, be like, can we?
Yeah.
Is this okay?
At this time, I mean, yeah, they were getting out of their contract, and it was mainly because they couldn't get distribution, like regular distribution for Daydream Nation. Like, all these critics were praising it, and they were like, when we go to record stores, we can't even get this record. Mm-hmm. And so they...
It's the big star story.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what has been said about this album, though, is this was the catalyst for Nirvana, Beck, all those people who joined DGC.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This was... Sonic Youth being on this major label, quote unquote major label, was proof that, like, you can do this.
But I mean, this is still just David Geffen, like, being like, yeah, yeah. Do what you want. You guys can do whatever you want.
Wasn't the Blue Album DGC also?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But there is also, Geffen has boundaries. Like, Tribe tried to get on Geffen and Geffen passed.
Yeah. But most of it had to do with a college radio DJ. His name is escaping me right now. And he got hired on at Geffen, and he was bringing his clout, was bringing the underground bands, because he would play them on his radio show, his college radio show. Sorry, I'm blanking on the name right now. But.
You're all right, man. I'm confusing. What?
Mark Cates he was straight out of college radio. That's his name. Yep.
What label was...
That's my favorite NWA album, straight out Primus of college
on?
Radio.
I thought they were on Geffen.
Probably.
Who was on
Geffen? Was Primus... Just did that.
Primus is on Interscope.
Interscope. Yeah, Interscope.
Okay. They let them do what they want to, though.
Interscope is not owned by Geffen.
No.
No. Interscope is owned by different billionaires.
Cool. I was confused.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got the last few minutes of Moat in our cans right now. That's where it loses me.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, not to belabor the point, but
no, I want to hear it.
When I said, like, oh, I don't like this track, it's not the part of the track that is, you know, a song.
The exciting sort of thing. I mean, this is still part of the song.
Exactly.
I will.
Right. I don't mean, I guess I that's, will, yeah. You should fight me on that point. You're right.
Yeah.
This is still part of the song. Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, this is part of the song.
It is.
If you got the sheet music, this would be there.
It would. And I think that is the identified portion of it, is you have to like accept that this is like the one continuous thing. And when they do those things live, like they do band into another song, like it will transition in a way that an album like this is very cut and dry, right? Like they cut it to My Friend Goo then.
Right.
Like, this is the next song. Live, they would like stretch it out, they would produce some noise, they would pull in this, it would swirl,
it becomes part of that audio wall.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then someone like Kim would like just kick off like playing like bass, and then Steve Shelley would kick into it, you know.
If it were something like that, I would like it more.
Yeah, there's different types too, you know.
Not to belabor this point about Geffen and Interscope. Interscope Records is an American record label owned by Universal Music Group through its Interscope Geffen A&M print.
Okay.
Geffen is, he has billions of dollars.
Yeah.
He owns everything.
Amazing.
Einhorn is Finkel?
Finkel is Einhorn, man.
Finkel is Einhorn.
Let's talk about Goo. Goo was also emerged from, since we're talking about Raymond Pettibon's work, Sir Drone. It was a punk rock story, and it was all about haircuts. Goo was his girlfriend and one of the two characters that hung out. So this was a movie that he created.
That Pettibon made?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
And love it. Goo was just, you know, a funny... They thought it was a funny name for this person, so they just started creating it.
Does the song follow the plot?
No.
Oh, okay, it's just...
No.
Yeah.
They just thought it would be a funny way to hold her up in a way. But yeah, there's other really cool things about, you know, these other songs. Cool Thing, obviously, is inspired by LL hit songs. I Can't Live Without My Radio and Going Back to Cali. And then Moat was lyrics inspired by Sylvia Plath's poem called The I Moat. And we just started free associating, you know, imagery and picked it up and, you know, penned it. Disappear is, which we're listening to right now, is Kim said a lot of that song has to do with these signs and your ability to control them. Don't let people to tell you what to do. No matter what, it was sort of interesting in the respect of seeing this photo, putting a halo over Tracy Lord's head to make it look, make her look saintly. And yeah, it was about sort of like people telling you what to do, but you have your own ideas. Other people say it's about UFOs. So.
Por que no los dos.
Exactly. But yeah, Titanium Exposé. Which was also featured on the Pump Up the Volume soundtrack, was a...
It's a good soundtrack.
Yeah. Straight ahead urban love song. And when he says urban, he means love ideas about two people living within their means. Artists in a place of poverty, but you're completely enriched by the creative connection that you have. So
that's cool.
Yeah. Also on that one, Kim sings the refrain from LL Cool J's Jinglin' Baby.
I'll have to listen for that again.
Yeah. I just love the transitions through everything. Like Disappear right now, like right after the chorus, it has that, goes high, it comes back down, goes right back into the verse.
Sounds very early 2000s indie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, just took, you know, everything that they were doing.
What are you telling me that Sonic Youth is influential?
Oh, I forgot to mention, of course, Tunic, Song for Karen. Thurston was kind of obsessed with Karen Carpenter and introduced Kim to the Carpenters. And they were so fascinated by her and a movie that they had seen from Todd Haynes, director called Superstar, when they did a Karen Carpenter story with Barbie dolls. And that movie was banned. Essentially, he couldn't release it because the Carpenters wouldn't allow this sort of story of her being anorexic and like her demanding mother and things like that. So, the song's all about, you know, Karen Carpenter. And they found a super fascinating about her voice and then seeing videos of the Carpenters in this like creepy, dark American, like, if you look past the sheen of what it was like representing to a lot of people, they saw this sort of like darkness underneath of those things.
Yeah, it's kind of a Mommy Dearest kind of thing. Yeah.
Maybe you should revisit that Carpenters record there, Friendo.
Oh, I love that record. I was on the positive.
Were you?
Yes.
I could have swore you were one of the fucking haters.
No.
That was me.
Ah, man.
There you go.
Yeah, and They were the breakout on that Carpenters tribute, If I Were a Carpenter.
I think so.
Yeah, Superstar was the song they did, and it's fucking brilliant, and the video is magical.
Yeah.
But the whole record's fucking great.
Bert, you want to talk about the videos for this record?
No, please, yeah.
Please.
I watched a few of them, but I have a feeling Bert has seen all of them.
Oh, absolutely. I can talk about all of them. Dirty Boots, great. Tunic, very cool, very lo-fi. I think what I love about all the different ones is it's like you have the hits, right? You have Dirty Boots, Cool Thing, and actually Titanium Exposé is a very kind of polished, in a sort of B-movie way. But then you have things like My Friend Goo, where it's just them in a room and they're looking at each other and they're like, hey, how about that Goo record? And then they just like put it on this like Fisher Price record player that sounds like...
I've got that record player.
Yep. And they just crank it up and she just dances and sings along while someone with like a video camera just films them dancing to the song, and that was the
sounds
video.
About right.
Yeah.
So is it the audio from the Fisher Price record player, or is it the
it
actual
is.
Release?
No.
Oh, nice. So it's like warbly.
Yep.
That's so cool.
Moat is a lot of stock imagery, and it has a sort of, what would you say, a surreal view. It's an experimental film by Lee, essentially, and it has corpses that you can't really tell are corpses because there's so much video feedback, and then like moving trains and cars and things like that. Scooter and Jinx was directed by Richard Kern, who was an early punk rock exploitation sort of filmmaker from New York. And it just has two ladies attacking each other and like making out. It's very strange. Mildred,
correct me
Pierce.
If I'm wrong, but Scooter and Jinx is just 1 minute, 5 seconds of Thurston Moore's blown amp, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Still a video. Cool.
They made a video for every single song. Yes. Wow.
Yeah. Mildred, Cinderella's big score is a wonderful like 8mm with Kim on a merry-go-round, just like with the camera on the other side. So it's very, it's like swirling around. And Mildred Pierce is... also uses Richard Kern footage, like 16 or 8mm, of them just playing in like a junkyard, and just gets super crazy at the end. They're all good. Not a bad one in the bunch. I highly recommend just like taking a night and, you know, instead of listening to the album, just go from track to track and watch all the videos, because they're really wonderful. All right, I'm getting way off topic.
You know who else loved this record? Robert Kreisgau.
Yeah, he came around.
Yeah. Quote, their first true major label album and first true song about stars. The bassist who has always been the paradigm-shifting guitar band's secret weapon. Maybe Kim Gordon overrates Karen Carpenter and undervalues Chuck D, but it's Tunic and Cool Thing you'll sing along with. Not Thurston Moore's pseudo-macho ZZ Top homage. Her friend Goo is your friend and my friend and the reason this music exists. In a world where songs are still counted girly, we need Goo. And it's her big sister's in my room ethereality, direct and spaced out at the same time that gives her a voice. A-.
Yeah. That cannot be overstated how Kim is like crucial to the band too.
Yeah.
I mean, all of them are very crucial.
I mean, 11 tracks, one of them that's just a blown speaker, and Kim wrote 4 of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, does double duty with Thurston on one of them. So 5 out of 11, that ain't bad.
Yeah.
Bert, awesome. You're a Sonic Youth nerd. Can you tell me, so this band has 2 guitar players. We got Thurston Moore. We've got Lee Ronaldo.
Mm-hmm.
What different, you were talking about how every member is so essential. What different things do both of those guys bring in their guitar work to what I'm hearing?
Yeah, good question. Lee Ronaldo's background is in psychedelic. So he is the one who is not ashamed to be like, yeah, I like the Grateful Dead. I like the hippie movement. And so when you hear his things, he's a little more on the side of that experimental, dark psychedelic, like in Moat. Moat is his song. I mean, he sings it, and that's what he writes like. Whereas Thurston has more of the, I would say, of the current, of the time. He was very, very into hardcore like super into punk rock, very into hardcore. And so he brings to the table not only the sort of rambunctious mess up my guitar and make a lot of noise, but also the sort of hooks that you're going to hear from a lot of grunge players like Nirvana or, you know, he kind of honed in on what was going around him at that time. Whereas Lee, I think he would have been the same no matter what. And then Kim has a very essential element of bringing in like pop hooks and then also being the like disquieting voice beneath a lot of those things. So Thurston can definitely sing. I mean, he's probably the singer. I mean, although I like all their voices. Thurston has the most traditional, I would say, singing style.
Yeah.
Whereas Lee is a lot more spoken word. And then Kim just has her own style, which is like Patti Smith or some, you know, you just can't quantify it.
Does Sonic Youth have three very short members, or is Thurston Moore 8 feet tall?
He's very tall.
All right.
They're all standing in hobbit trenches.
I see band photos of him. It looks like half the band is standing in a hole.
No, he's just that tall.
Yeah, Kim's pretty tall too.
Yeah.
Like.
All right, I'll just do a couple more. Sorry, I didn't mean to. I'm not boxing anybody out. Okay. I get so excited about Sonic Youth, you guys.
Riff, buddy.
Can't stand it.
Riff.
If I had to say, too, this album is on par. It is up there with the sort of Nirvana breakout. Like, this was the time. This was the album. Like, if anything was going to do it, it was like.
Have you seen that documentary? Time.
Yeah, Year Punk Broke.
Year Punk Broke?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, it's so good.
It's just, there was something, I think everybody who is on there kind of knew something was like happening. And they sold 200,000 copies of this album.
By December. When was it released?
Mm-hmm. It was released in June.
Okay, yeah, 200,000 copies in 6 months is nothing for to sniff at, man. Yeah, shit, that's great.
For sure.
Birch, do you like this one better than Daydream Nation?
I go back and forth. It's weird because I like them for different reasons. But I will say Daydream and this are probably my favorites. If I had to guess, I will say adding the videos to this like really helps and is really interesting because it just gives you that much more dynamic. It does have a little bit. It is a little cleaner. I will say that. So it doesn't have that. It's not as introspective, but sometimes I like that. I go back and forth trying to decide. It's like sometimes I would just put this one on or Dirty on because they're a little bit shorter. But if I really want to get into a Sonic Youth album, I would put Daydream Nation on.
Okay.
They're all good.
I agree.
I found a copy of Dirty at a used CD store when I was like 14 years old. And I didn't know anything about Sonic Youth except I knew the name. And at the time, I wasn't ready for it. So I'm looking forward to revisiting it when we get to it. Yeah
This is definitely a winner for me. I mean, it's so good. I can't express how wonderful Sonic Youth is, and at this time, this is, if I were to tell someone to start in on a Sonic Youth record, this one.
Really?
Or Dirty.
Okay.
This one just has a lot going for it. It comes out swinging with Dirty Boots. So if you're in for that and you're in for, you know, like Tunic, it's probably, you're probably going to like the rest of the record, or you're part of it at least.
Yeah.
It has such good playing, good ideas. Every song feels unique and different. They have the extended jams, but they don't go as far as like Expressway to Your Skull, where it's like an 8 to 10 minute jam. Even Moat like keeps it under control. So,
man, I might go evil if I'm trying to get someone to introduce to it. That one blew my fucking hair back when we did it. I'm a positive. This is my wheelhouse.
Yeah,
this is where I like to hang out. This is the noisy bullshit that I'm into. Yeah. So, positive.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I'm positive. I think it's just going to take a lot more listens for me to appreciate the parts and the tracks that I'm not so comfortable with. But the parts and the tracks that I am comfortable with are fucking rad.
Nice. So it's you feel uncomfortable listening to it?
Well, it's just it takes me out of it. Where I could see what you're saying about the live experience, because there are other albums that we're going to talk about where the sheer noise and the way they are structuring the sound itself is bringing you to a particular mental state, you know? And so I could see where if you were chaining the end of Moat into something else, and I'm there between the speakers just getting hammered, that could be an experience for me. That could be something important musically for me. But on an album where they cut it, or an album where it's just a piece of noise for a minute or something in the middle of a couple other tracks, it doesn't connect to me.
Yeah. Cool. What do you think, Ben?
Positive for me. I think it's they're striking a good balance of noise jams and straightforward rock and some pop sensibilities on this one. I agree that would be a good entry point for Sonic Youth. I don't have much more to say that hasn't already been said, but I'm on the positive for this one.
Next time we'll be talking about Ride Nowhere.
Uh-oh.
All right, thanks, y'all.